I'm Mark Peterson, and this is the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast. We're on episode 17. This is where we love giving well. Those of you who are familiar with the work of Stronger Philanthropy this year will be familiar with the Spark Initiative. This was a pilot project for younger social entrepreneurs who applied for and received grants to undertake their work. We funded this project through a small Canadian denomination, BIC Canada, and it really flowed out of a personal connection I had with Krista Hesklink, who is today's guest. Our funding partners joined together to award over $100,000 as an innovative investment in the next generation of charitable action. The project was Krista's brainchild, and today you'll hear how it all came to be. In today's conversation, we discuss this emerging movement for social enterprise that is largely being pioneered by the millennial generation, who is approaching nonprofit work differently than previous generations. We conclude by sharing our guilty pleasure. Both Krista and I have walked the Camino in Spain multiple times, and we just can't help but reflect on how these long pilgrimages have changed us and changed how we do our work of philanthropy. Let's go to Krista now. Krista, welcome to the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Glad we could cross paths today. Mm-hmm. We even had a random encounter at Starbucks this morning.
We did. It was a beautiful moment of serendipity because I was going to meet you in a totally different location. And we discovered we were on the same way, on the same path, heading to the same direction. So it's perfect.
So first of all, I'm interested in your background and the role that you have here at BIC Canada. Mm-hmm. And kind of the journey that you've been on over these years. Maybe you can just fill in the gaps for our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I had never heard of BIC, Brethren in Christ, until 2002 when I stumbled upon the Meeting House, which is a church within the denomination. And I started attending the Meeting House in Hamilton then, and a couple years later I came on staff. And I was a pastor at the Meeting House for quite some time. I'm no longer on staff at the Meeting House, but I am working part-time with the denomination and have been doing so for 2 years as the Director of Next Generation Engagement.
Okay, so what does that involve exactly?
Yeah, specifically two programs is what I direct in my part-time hours. One is called the Flow Internship, and it is a design-your-own paid internship for young adults 18 to 25, particularly young adults in the summers who are interested in working in a church or working in a non-for-profit. And then we spend our time developing them beyond their experience in their actual job on leadership development and spiritual formation. So over the last 2 years, we've had 20 young adults go through the internship program. And it's fantastic. So that's the Flow Internship. And then the other program I work on is the Spark Initiative, which I think is why we're here. And it's a program that you and I worked on together. And the Spark Initiative is getting behind the inspired spark of young social entrepreneurs. And it was a grant-making experience. And we've just been spending our last year doing it for the first time. And now we have 8 grant receivers representing 7 organizations that are going to receive financial support and mentorship for the next 10 months. And these people are from all over the country doing fantastic things.
Well, that's really interesting. Back up a bit and tell us how this Spark Initiative idea started. What was the genesis of that? How did that start in your own mind?
It was about 4 or 5 years ago, I think about 5 years ago, and a bunch of the leaders from the Meeting House and the Brethren in Christ denomination, we went down to Washington, D.C. to the Q conference. I don't know if some of your listeners are familiar with Q, but we went there and we were very interested in one of the things we saw. I mean, the whole conference was great, but we were really interested in something that was getting behind social entrepreneurs, influenced by their faith to do some beautiful things in their communities for the most vulnerable and marginalized. And it was being sort of partnered with an organization called Praxis Labs in the States. So we just attended this event at this conference and I was captivated. I remember sort of nudging the people I was sitting next to, like, we got to do something like this. And this was about 5 years ago. Well, lots of transitions happened within different leadership who attended that conference. And it kind of was an idea that I kept percolating on, hoping that something like that could happen somewhere. And so when I got into my role a couple of years ago, I always thought that might be something that worked really well under my strategic initiative, Getting Behind a New Wave of Young Leaders, this mm-hmm. idea that if the church as an institution really is interested in getting behind a new wave of young leaders, developing them, supporting them, mentoring them, equipping them, giving them the tools they need to flourish, we should be looking not only at leaders who want to work within the church, who feel that sense of calling to formal pastoral ministry and then developing them, but also young leaders who want to use their own gifts and skill and strength and experience and find themselves outside of a vocation within the actual church, that they want to be kingdom leaders doing beautiful things, influenced by their faith, but they're not called to a sense of church ministry
mm-hmm.
or even non-for-profit leadership in some cases. So we thought, how would we be able to also get behind a new wave of young leaders, folks who are in the business sector or the education sector or the small business sector? And so that idea kept sort of percolating. And so I approached our leadership team, my colleagues, and I just said, hey, I'd like to pitch an idea. And that was about a year and a half ago.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's always struck me that BIC being a smaller denomination,
yeah,
mm-hmm. It has the agility, it has the flexibility to make kind of, you know, bold jumps in direction, which you were able to take advantage of there for the purpose of the Spark Initiative, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a nimbleness that comes with being small. And I think when you have very clear and solid strategic initiatives in any organization, and you have the nimbleness and a sense of leaders who are entrepreneurial in many ways, which I think that does, I could categorize myself as that type of leader,
mm-hmm.
Then, you know, the stars align.
Yeah.
And when you make a pitch, if it is the right time, which it was for us, we said, yes, let's try this. It's a pilot. We may only do it once, but we believe this could actually be a real positive contribution to the kingdom, even though it may not actually impact our constituency directly. If we have, you know, one finalist of the Spark Initiative who takes an idea and really makes a profound impact across the country and even around the globe, then it's worth our investment, even if it was just done once.
Right.
So I'm really, you know, proud of us in a way to take that risk, because it's a risk. You know, when we said, yes, let's try this, we didn't have, you know, the philanthropists lined up.
Yeah.
We weren't even sure what we were calling this thing. We really built it from the ground up. And that's where I'm so grateful that, you know, our paths crossed in the way that it did, because we couldn't have done it without you and Stronger Philanthropy.
Maybe just recount how that happened,
yeah,
because that's kind of a new
yeah.
story.
Well, I actually have a very vivid memory. It was in my car, and my car was sort of my little remote office, and I had to pull off to the side of the road because I had this phone meeting scheduled in my calendar with Mark Peterson. And I was calling you from my car specifically because I knew that you did grant-making things, and I didn't know much about it, but I knew I needed to learn. So I remember having a conversation with you and specifically saying, like, Mark, I probably will want to apply for one of your grants, but I actually would much rather just have you as a mentor through this process. So if there's a conflict of interest, I won't apply for anything. Let's just have a good conversation about grant making and that process and even what does it mean to fundraise and find donors who would be interested in something like this. And you were generous with your ideas and thoughts. And then it was probably 6 weeks or 8 weeks later, maybe, and you called me up and just said, I think maybe there's a way for us to partner even more significantly than me just being a listening ear.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I realized at the time what that was actually going to look like. But, you know, I consider you an absolute partner in the Spark Initiative and Stronger Philanthropy. We really probably wouldn't have been where we are today, in the way that we got here, which to me felt very natural and easy and sort of doors opening quite well for a new pilot initiative.
Right.
And I think that has lots to do with what you're up to. So,
yeah. Yeah. From my end, it was just such an interesting coincidence in a way
mm-hmm.
of having that initial conversation with you. And from my end, I was also percolating on the idea of expanding our grants to startups. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not been an emphasis that we've ever had. We've really shied away from startup initiatives in the past, mm-hmm. In terms of our granting for our partners. But I have one particular partner that's in my group that keeps pestering me year after year. He suggests the idea, you know what, we really need to do some startups. And so anyway, his voice was in my head. And when you laid out your plans, I thought, you know what, there's a synergy there. And I think that we could maybe work something out. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it all kind of flowed together and how Spark Initiative ended up receiving the support of Stronger Philanthropy.
That's right.
So.
No, it was wonderful. And the year flew by in many ways because we sort of agreed that we would partner together. Still not entirely sure, I think, what that meant, but we knew that we were going to do that. And I think we felt right away where our specific expertise was going to come in and the gifts that we each had to bring to make sure this came together. Mm-hmm. I remember early in 2016, we were, you know, developing our online platform, like the website. You, of course, had your own platform, which we worked with. We had a whole initiative to get the word out. I think that was my biggest fear. There was a few points in this whole process. I'm like, this isn't going to work if we don't get applicants and if we don't get good applicants. So we ended up opening it up in March. And in May, when we closed the application process, we had 42 applications from across the country.
Right.
And they were all, you know, really encouraging to see what young entrepreneurs were doing.
All social entrepreneurs.
All social entrepreneurs, both kind of some people clearly in the business for profit mode, but of course philanthropic in their efforts and their end goals, and others coming at it more from a ministry perspective and laying on the business model to it. And I think both are very legitimate in the space, but they also feel very different.
Right.
And it was nice for us to have the goal that we were probably going to land somewhere around 8 finalists at the end of the day. And right. So we went through that process of 42, then we narrowed it down to 20, narrowed down to 15 and 12. And then we went out and we realized we were going to require a second application from everyone and a in-person interview.
Right.
And then we brought those sort of 12 finalists that had been fully vetted to our judging group.
Right. Can you just make a comment on the application process and how that served your needs?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Well,
the platform that you use.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the platform that Stronger Philanthropy has in place is clearly been well used and well developed and tweaked over the years. It was a simple platform, not only for the users, the applicants themselves going online, using that back-end platform. And the portal, I think, is what we call it. And then for me as a sort of partner with Stronger Philanthropy, it was very, very user-friendly because all of the information was already there. We were able to evaluate very, very easily. And as a team of evaluators, we could do that all together, pool it all into one space.
Yeah.
So that when it came time for us to actually look at what we were doing, it became very, very easy. So that to me was well worth the investment that we made in with Stronger Philanthropy. I mean, we could have created our own application platform and online experience, but it would have been, quite frankly, a disaster compared to yours.
It beats getting Word and Excel files.
Oh my, I know. It was brilliant. So, yeah. and it served our judges well.
Yeah.
You know, so from 42 applications down to 7 organizations receiving a grant, was just brilliant.
So seven organizations were the final recipients of these awards. $100,000 in grant money went to those.
Yeah, I think it was $115,000 of grant money total, plus another $35,000 investment into their mentorship experience.
Right.
So we have retreats that we're doing. We have an online course that they've received.
And so the incubator idea is an important part of the whole startup initiative.
Yeah, I mean, for us, we could have just focused on the grant being a financial award.
Yeah.
Or we could have just focused it on just being mentorship. You know, I think when I was doing my research of other organizations that are doing this and speaking with some of those leaders, it became really clear, really obviously that the probably the best version at this point is the complement of both finances. And we're not just talking about grants of $800 or $1,000, but to the tune of $10,000, $15,000 to $20,000 for these startups. So we were looking for specific organizations who at least had a very strong potential and clear leadership to take initiative or had already been in the space for 1, 2, or 3 years and would still be considered startup. But we also knew we needed to have some mentorship as well with that. And I know you and I were both encouraged and maybe even a little bit surprised at how that mentorship piece became so important for the people who we were interviewing, those final 12. I mean, they lit up when we were interviewing them about what the grant would be. And they were asking about mentorship. They wanted to know more about the mentorship. They said the reason why they were applying for the grant was because of the mentorship. And I think that's a really important message for all of us and those of you who are listening to this is that, you know, money is very important, obviously makes the world go around, but we have to get behind leaders by putting time and investment into them. And I think seasoned leaders actually can do that quite easily because we've been down the road.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to share some of our experience and guidance. And,
That brings us to an interesting point, and that's that the Spark Initiative was directed at millennials.
Yes.
As being the social entrepreneurs that we wanted to invest in. And yet, I think that I know I certainly learned so much about that generation from working with this group. And maybe you can reflect on that a bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm still learning.
And you're an expert in this area because you work with these people all the time.
Yeah, I hate to say I'm an expert. I think millennials get a really bad rap, to be quite honest. I think there's, you know, there's sometimes the joke about, well, there's even like, you know, memes online about how off the wall this group is. I just think that's not fair. I don't think that they're entitled. I think they're generally scared. And I'll unpack that a little bit. It may feel like entitlement, but I think it's just a way of masking fear. One of the things that I've been learning over the course of the last number of years, working with young adults and millennials. Now, this Spark Initiative was geared at under 35 years of age, partly because we knew we weren't interested in half-baked ideas from high schoolers. I mean, that's not a bad thing, but there's other groups doing that. And we knew that we wanted to have, you know, leaders in their own right who maybe have graduated or finished their graduate degree and have tried a couple things and failed, and now they're onto their second or third idea. And so there may be 28, 29. The average age is 28 who applied. But when I look at younger people, 30 and under, if you will, 35 and under, their experience of the world is quite different than those of us who are older. We did not have the experience of the world at our fingertips, quite literally with the phone, you know, the smartphone. We didn't have that. We didn't have the globalized experience of we're all just one big family of humans on this planet because we didn't have the same sense of interconnectivity. And we also had a different way of learning. So we were a little bit more of the pedagogy in our own experience, whether it was in our own families being raised or our education, was more, this is how you do it, so you better learn it so that you can do it.
More linear.
Linear, more rote, you know? And we can't underestimate just how that even wires our brains and how we view the world and our own capacity and our own abilities. Now you look at a millennial approach and how they've been taught. They've been given two things. They've been said, you can change the world and the world needs your help because now you see the mess we're in. And we're not going to really teach you how to do anything specifically. We're going to teach you, though, how you find how you do it. You know, so, you know, when we were growing up, we would never ask ourselves a question and then not worry about not knowing the answer. When we grew up, we did worry about not knowing the answer, and we would have to find it out, and we'd have to work hard to find the answer, and we'd have to memorize it because we wouldn't want to do all that hard work again to figure it out. Now, we ask Siri on our phone. and we Google it. So millennials are sort of between a rock and a hard place in that they're impassioned to meet the needs of the world that they see in ways that we never experienced. And they've been told you can change the world because, you know, quite literally everything's at your fingertips, but they inherently come to situations knowing that they don't know how to do it. I'm simplifying it, but I think then what ends up happening, my experience is that the millennial generation has more fear and insecurity and just general anxiety.
Thus the need for mentorship.
Thus the need for mentorship.
Walking together with someone, right?
Yeah, my favorite quote is by Brené Brown. She says, you learn to swim by swimming and you learn to courage by couraging. Well, we had sort of the innate muscles of courage built a little bit more at a younger age just because of how we were raised and the opportunities we had and the ways that we went about doing life. This generation needs to have people who can show them that they can do it and to walk alongside them so that they build those courage muscles. And I think that's why mentoring is so important. And I have no doubt that, you know, these leaders who are leaders in their own right and already having sort of some track record of couraging, that the Spark Initiative is just really going to take them to the next level.
That's great. Mm-hmm. I want to jump to another topic, and that's the book that you've just written. And it's actually a really great alignment with what we've been talking about up till now, because your book is about taking risks and jumping across that void, you know. And I think you would say that it's best to do that in community. And that's what you're saying with this idea of mentorship as well. So just tell us a little bit about your book, the title of it, and you just came out with this a year ago?
Not even a year. It feels like a long time ago, but it's been a little over six months that it officially came out. So the book's called Life's Great Dare, Risking It All for the Abundant Life. And it actually was birthed about 18 years ago out of really, really dark, hard life experience
of your own,
of my own. An illness. I was diagnosed with cancer at the age of 24, and then at the same time, a couple months later, my only sibling, my brother, was killed in a car accident. So I never had a desire to write a book, and quite honestly, when I started writing, it wasn't because I was writing a book. I was just feeling about 5 years ago, I need to start writing my story down. And as I did that over the course of the next year or two, I just realized that what was coming to the surface was the miracle that I at one point could be face down in the death zone of life, emotionally, spiritually, physically. And then to be at a place 15 years later, flourishing and grateful for my life. That to me was miraculous, and it speaks to a very profound transformation. So the book is essentially about transformation, and that life's greatest dare is to surrender to the transformation that God has for us. And that is a risk, but what we're doing is we're risking it all for the abundance of life, the life that we're really designed to experience. And
so it's possible to get out of that hole.
Oh, well, yeah.
you've done it.
I have. And, you know, we have this in the sort of grand dramas of our life, the real hard stuff. But even in the minutia, even in the places where we say, you know, I'm not living the best version of myself, there's something more for me. There's more of this abundance that God has created us for that I'm not quite there. And we all have that in the minutia of our lives. And I think that God is also interested in transforming us, not because he's trying to make us more perfect so he that can love us more, but that we can experience his love more perfectly. And that's what the book's about. And it was a great experience. I self-published the book. I'm giving 100% of the proceeds away. So over $25,000 has been given away.
Good for you.
Yeah.
So you're a philanthropist as well.
I guess so.
Who have you invested in with your philanthropy?
That's right. The two organizations is World Vision and Mennonite Central Committee. And those two organizations are chosen very poignantly because I have traveled many, many times to Southern Africa and other parts of the world to see their work firsthand. And I want to be able to speak intelligently about their organizations. I want to feel good about giving the proceeds of the money of the book away. And And so those two are very strategic. So the World Vision program is safe spaces for children in Syria in refugee camps. And then the MCC program is one in Mozambique, which is a girls training facility for high schoolers who wouldn't normally go to high school in the rural Mozambique. So
that's really exciting.
It is.
Congratulations
on
that.
Thank you.
Let's transition to the walk. You and I have walked a long way, not just through the Spark Initiative, but actually across Spain a few times. Not together.
No.
But this is something we have in common. I sign off all of my podcasts with the phrase Buen Camino, which is have a good way, have a good walk. And I think you've had a good walk. I want you to tell us a little bit about that walk.
Sure.
And what it's meant for you.
It's funny that you sign your podcast off with Buen Camino, because I sign all of my books with Utrea.
Okay.
Which is another ancient pilgrim greeting, mean keep going. I've known about you, Mark, for a number of years, but I haven't known you obviously that well until this last year or so. And I had planned on walking the Camino de Santiago. I had read a book by Arthur Boers a number of years ago.
Right.
I always wanted to do it. And then in 2014, I ended up planning my trip. And I think I was about three or four weeks away from leaving for Spain. And I found out that you were walking with your son.
Yeah.
So our first experience on the Camino was the same year, 2014.
Yeah, same summer.
Same summer. We both walked the Camino Frances. I think you ended up being 2 weeks ahead of, 2 or 3 weeks ahead of me. I think you were still on the Camino
when you
in Galicia when I was starting in Saint-Jean.
Yeah.
So, I could talk for days about the Camino. It was incredibly profound and transformative. The first summer was 32 days from Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port to Santiago.
And walking every day.
I walked every day. I never took a day off, although I slowed my pace down considerably in the middle because I was nursing a very painful shin splint. And I probably should have stopped. Looking back now, I know I did embrace my pace, if you will, but I probably should have embraced it.
You're barreling on ahead, right?
I embraced my pace a little more and actually stopped for a day. I think the shortest day I walked was maybe 8 kilometers, just so I could get to the next town.
Yeah.
And it was my favorite part of the experience was just the walking. I would wake up in the dark and I would walk for 6 or 7 hours and I would have, you know, of course, your 2 breakfasts and snacks, and I loved watching the world wake up and hearing the world wake up and smelling the world wake up and feeling the world wake up from dark to light. And it was incredibly profound experience on so many levels. I feel like I came back reborn in many ways. It sounds a little cliche, but it was really incredibly profound. So much so that I probably have not had one day since that first morning in the Pyrenees in 2014 where I haven't thought about the Camino. And then I went back again this summer, 2016.
As did I.
I know you did. I was so jealous because you, one, were doing a different route, and two, you were going for the whole thing again. And I had only 3 weeks of time.
Yeah.
And I didn't have much time or energy to plan a different route. And I was actually very curious to go back to the scene of the crime, like the first summer, because I just couldn't believe how much it impacted me. And I almost wanted to go back to the same place and walk those same steps and just have what happened, you know, that summer. So I went back to Saint-Jean and I walked to Burgos, 12 days. I took a bus to Santiago and then I walked the 4 days from Santiago to Finisterre because I hadn't done that before.
Yeah.
And so 16 days in total this past summer. And, I can't believe I'm saying it again, but I really hope I am on the Camino again next summer.
Yeah.
I don't know what that will look like yet.
How does it change you, do you think?
Oh, wow. You know, I think for me personally, I often live my life, my personality, for good or for bad, is quite other-centered. And I don't mean that in an egotistical, I mean that in sometimes the worst sort of ways.
Yeah.
I people please, and I'm that's my personality. I work hard so that I can get affirmation from others. I mean, I don't want to get, this is not a psychology podcast. So. But all that to say, when you're on the, for me, when I'm on the Camino, I'm not others centered. I'm inward focused. I'm quieting myself so that I can get in touch with who I really am and who God really sees me as. Mm-hmm. It's a detox experience for me. Mm-hmm. It's not just the simpler life, which of course it is. It's not just the quieter life, which of course it is, but it is just the, it's that sort of slow step-by-step emerging of your true self. I don't know how else to describe it. And for me, you know, 16 days was significant this last summer, but I could even tell then, I'm like, man, if I had another 16, I would probably feel just as euphoric as I did that first summer when I walked into Santiago 32 days later. Mm. It felt like I was calm and clear and confident and had nothing to prove. Mm. And that's what it felt like both times. And yeah. I think that's what happens when you just get in touch with who you really are. You're like, I'm enough just the way I am.
Yeah.
And I'm not perfect, but I'm enough. And that, I think, is the gift. That's not to say it also doesn't change you, because you start then realizing that we're all pilgrims on this journey. So you meet people from all over the world, from all walks of life, absolutely different ideologies and religions and backgrounds and languages and political theories. Everyone's different, but what really matters on the Camino ends up being the only thing that matters. And that is, you're just a fellow pilgrim on this journey walking, and you're all doing it together, and you're here to help, and you're here to, you know, reflect on your own journey, but then also to be a part of other people's journeys. And some of my favorite experiences on the both of my Caminos are just the conversations I've had and the people I've met. And it's just beautiful. I would love everyone to get there.
Well, as a fellow pilgrim, I've been so privileged to walk with you this year. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to many more steps together.
Thank you. Me too, Mark.
I'm going to make sure that we put links in the show notes to your book. We'll include Arthur Brewer's book as well.
Great.
So people know how to get to that work on the Camino. The Way is Made by Walking.
The Way is Made by Walking, yeah.
And we'll link as well to BIC Canada and the Spark Initiative.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Krista, for your friendship and for leading change through your charitable work. There is a unique and powerful spark that can occur when philanthropists drop their guard long enough to collaborate with charity leaders such as Krista. Rather than dividing the world into us and them, greater change can occur when we brainstorm, plan, and take action together. Often the financial piece is the logjam that prevents charitable creativity from flowing freely. I hope today's podcast inspires you to advance with your charitable partners, and that visionary creativity can be unleashed. We are all stronger when we walk together. In the show notes today, you'll find links to the Spark Initiative, to Krista's book, Life's Great Dare, and to other organizations and books we mentioned in today's conversation. That concludes today's podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our website at strongerphilanthropy.ca, or you can find us on iTunes or your Android podcatcher apps. If you want to reach out, connect by email at strongerphilanthropy@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter @LoveGivingWell and Facebook @StrongerPhilanthropy. Buen Camino.